Therefore, like as May month flowereth and flourish in many gardens, so in likewise let every man of worship flourish his heart in the world, first unto God, and next unto the joy of them that he promised his faith unto. For there never was worshipful man or worshipful woman, but they loved one better than another. And worship in arms may never be foiled, but first reserve the honor to God. And secondly, the quarrel must come of thy lady. And such love I call virtuous love. But nowadays, men cannot love seven night, but they must have all their desires, that love may not endure by reason, for when they soon accord that hasty heat, soon it cooleth. Right so fareth love nowadays, soon hot, soon cold. This is no stability. But the old love was not so. Men and women could love together 7 years, and no liqueur's lust were between them. And then was love, truth, and faithfulness. And lo, in likewise was used love in King Arthur's days. Wherefore I like love nowadays unto summer and winter, for like the one is hot and the other cold, so fareth love nowadays. Therefore all you that could be lovers, call unto your remembrance the month of May, like as did Queen Guinevere, for whom I make here a little mention, that while she lived, she was a true lover, and therefore she had a good end. Hello and welcome. I'm Douglas Bowles, and this is 42 Minutes, a podcast about meaning from SyncBook Radio and distributed by thesyncbook.com. You can find our archives at 42minutes.com, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail at 42minutes.com. It's Friday, December 20th, 2024. Happy solstice. And horse and man were smote to the earth, and he cleaved his helm to the clavicle. Are you ready for some blood? La Morte d'Arthur, our fall. Is it fall? It's our seasonal book club. It must be the fall book club.
The Fall of Arthur.
It is. The Fall of Arthur is a 15th century Middle English prose reworking by Sir Thomas Malory of tales about the legendary King Arthur, Guinevere, Lancelot, Merlin, and the Knights of the Round Table, along with their respective folklore. In order to tell a complete story of Arthur from its conception to his death, Malory compiled, rearranged, interpreted, and modified material from various French and English sources. Today, this is one of the best-known works of Arthurian literature. Many authors since the 19th century revival of the legend have used Malory as their principal source. Apparently written in prison at the end of the medieval English era, La Morte d'Arthur was completed by Malory around 1470 and was first published in a printed edition in 1485 by William Caxton. Until the discovery of the Winchester manuscript in 1934, the 1845 edition was considered the earliest known text and the closest to Malory's original version. Modern editions under myriad titles are inevitably variable, changing spelling, grammar, and pronouns for the convenience of readers of modern English, as well as often abridging or revising the material. Malory addresses his contemporary preoccupations with legitimacy and societal unrest, which will appear throughout La Morte d'Arthur. His concern reflects the 15th century England, where many were claiming the rights to power through violence and bloodshed. The prose style, which mimics historical documents of the time, lends an air of authority to the whole work. This allowed contemporaries to read the book as history rather than a work of fiction, therefore making it a model of order for Malory's violent and chaotic times. At the vigil of Pentecost, when all the fellowship of the Round Table were come unto Camelot, and there heard their service, and the tables were ready set for the meat. I don't know what I was doing here. How are you doing, Snore? I think we've lost the grail completely.
Yeah, I'm all right. A bit of a cold, so.
Yeah, you sound rough.
So how are we gonna deal with this one?
How are we gonna deal with this one?
My copy has 940 pages.
Well, so I think I made a giant mistake with Mallory. You're gonna tell me how great he is, but I'm gonna tell you how much I hate him for a while, I think. Well, so, boy, he's done something really remarkable here, but I think there are scholars who won't necessarily say that, like, the prose is necessarily remarkable.
Right. Yeah, actually, I might agree with you on Mallory. I think just spoiled by the earlier Grail stuff, right?
Yeah. So there's a touch of reality in the Chrétien and the Wolfram. And this feels like all right, so here's my horrible rendering. Like, what it feels like is medieval joust box scores. You know, like if you read the baseball box scores in a newspaper, you get an idea of what happened during the game.
Right.
And so we're getting like all the box scores for every joust that ever happened. Yeah. Ever. Yeah. And yeah, there's a lot of smoting and.
yeah. No, you're right. Like the whole huge middle section, I guess, is all. Is all jousting and matches and I don't know, we have to get deeper into it. Like it's basically to talk about who is the best worldly knight, yeah, and then the difference between the worldly knight and then the spiritual knight that comes later, yeah.
So
the big question with Mallory is unity and coherence. Like, does it cohere? You know, does it all fit together?
It does. I don't know. Like, if you look too closely at the seams, you're like, what? You know, this is like Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah, the timeline is way off. Like, people have been trying to figure out how exactly the timeline is structured, and it doesn't completely work any way you put it. But in terms of themes, I think what he's doing is he's making the contrast, like I said, of the worldly knight and the spiritual knight, and what needs to eventually happen to produce someone like Galahad who achieves the Grail in the end.
Right.
But then it's tied up, like it's tied up with King Arthur's kingdom. And everything.
Well, he
else,
embodies the whole story.
Yeah.
Well, and so it starts kind of,
yeah,
with Arthur.
It's either him, it's him or Lancelot who's the hero of the whole thing, right? Arguably Lancelot, because he gets the last word, right?
Well, I didn't make it.
Oh, you didn't?
I made it through once before in the past, but so what the mistake I made was that I started into it too late. And like you said, so the Sir Tristram portion is 2/3 of the book.
Yeah.
And all the wind was out of my sails when I was done with Sir Tristram. And so that's the other interesting thing, is that you can see each of these different heroes. Like if you wanted to go and find the different tales, maybe in a more poetic manner, like I think those exist. Like we could. You could, like, we didn't touch on Tristram at all. You know,
right,
this is the first time. Oh, that was something. So last time you were talking about feutering your spear, and I'm like, oh, I don't know what that is. That sounds, that doesn't sound good. It sounds, but I think you were reading, like, it must have been either Deboron or their continuations are more in line with this stuff, or this stuff, you know, fed into Mallory.
Yeah. I forget where that line's from. It must have been from the continuations, maybe, or something. Yeah.
There's a lot of feutering, which is just to ready your spear.
Yeah.
Your lance.
Yeah. That's one way to talk about it, is in terms of the whole of Arthurian literature and trying to piece it together like that. Which, like you said in your intro, Mallory is using all kinds of different sources, but one of his primary sources probably is the Vulgate tradition from France. It's also called the Lancelot Grail cycle. There's the Vulgate, and then there's the post-Vulgate, which are sort of continuations on that. Yeah.
And I read a little bit about that too, and you know, as that tradition develops too, they're tweaking it so that they can, you know, it never does achieve thematically, like, because these are organic things, they're still trying to get the stories to do what they need them to do.
Yeah. So in the Vulgate, that's when the character of Galahad is introduced, right? And so Galahad, prior to the Vulgate, right, the main Grail Knight is Percival, right? And we've already read about Percival in Chrétien and von Eschenbach, right? And then in the Mabinogion too, right? Like, it's all of the early romances are about Percival achieving the Grail, but in the Vulgate, it's Percival's not pure enough, basically, right? He's already been, he's not a pure maiden, as they say in this one. So then this character Galahad comes out, but I think the main purpose for Galahad is to unite or gather together all of the Lancelot tales, which is sort of a different tradition in a way. Like, there's all these Lancelot stories that were happening before, and the Galahad theme, because Galahad's the son of Lancelot, kind of illegitimate son, Lancelot gets tricked into having the son through the Lady Elaine, but
Morgan Le Fay that did the enchanting?
I was gonna look that up again just to make it clear, but I thought I think Merlin had a hand in it as well, even though Merlin is probably out of the picture by then, but
he is
in some of the romances, but he definitely foretold the coming of Galahad, right? So he did sort of have a hand in it in that way, right? And in the same way that he had a hand in the beginning of Arthur at the beginning, right? Like, you remember that part? Like, he disguised.
Yes.
Merlin disguised Uther Pendragon.
Uther Pendragon.
And he's one of his captains, and Merlin himself, and they were able to get into this this castle of one of the lords.
The Duke of Cornwall?
Yeah, the Duke of Cornwall, Sir Hole or something. They got into this castle where he was holding up his wife, like securing his wife, because the whole battle between them started because of Arthur liking his wife, and Sir Hole was
Uther.
Jealous.
Yeah.
And so she was sort of locked in the secure tower. Merlin changed their form so that Arthur looked exactly like the Duke of Cornwall, and then he was able to come in and sleep with Ygraine, I think her name is.
Yeah.
And then she became pregnant with Arthur, right? And And so Merlin did that because he foresaw that this king would come about, like this had to happen, right? So there's that sort of parallel between Arthur and Galahad, yeah?
So the early section, it was my favorite of this. So like, yeah. Balin, the two brothers that have basically the same names that are spelled slightly different, and they achieve the swords, and young Arthur,
yeah,
running around with Merlin. That's the best stuff, or the stuff that I enjoyed the most out of this, even though there's so much meat in there that you would hope, you know, some of the other tales would deliver.
Yeah, so he's taking that stuff, like the early stuff, there's a whole bunch of different things talking about Arthur and his early days, and then Uther Pendragon, his father, and that all comes from the earliest sources, Geoffrey de Monmouth. Yeah. Did you ever get to read that? Or?
And then I have in the past. I flipped through it. I didn't. It wasn't something that there. So the journey has been really strange for me, in that like we settle into like this moment or space, and then I'm so like I was taken with Chaucer this time,
right?
And like I had this note that I just read. Where is it? I want to say that the end of the Knight's Tale is really hitting correctly after the Trump victory. And I wrote that on November 9th, and I'm like, man, I wonder what the heck I was talking about. I'm going to have to go back and look at the Knight's Tale. Oh, and that I need to make a correction. So I kept thinking that Chaucer was Old English.
No, yeah, Middle English, yeah.
It's Middle English, but even though there was 100 years between Chaucer and
Mallory.
Mallory, it is comprehensible. When I was trying to comprehend Chaucer in its own, on its own terms, for whatever reason, I appreciate the weird spelling. Like, I'd rather have the original text than... it slows you down and makes you actually read it.
Yeah, I had the original spelling in my copy of Mallory, which is good and bad. Like if I got really into it, it was great. If I was really concentrated.
Yeah.
But if I just wanted to sort of lightly read it, it's hard to do that. And, I would end up missing parts, and I'd have to go back and try to read it again. So it's tricky. But Chaucer is even like you said, it's earlier, so it's still Middle English, but it's even more difficult to read, I'd say. But I haven't got into Chaucer at all yet, so I don't have much to say about that. Although I know that there's some Arthurian stuff in there.
There is the thing that was striking me about this moment that was happening before Mallory. So like Mallory's 15th century, but the 14th century, you really got this impression that they were taken with the classical world, especially Ovid. You know, yeah. So like they're talking about Roman deities, you know, so which was really interesting in like some of the Chaucerian. I don't know if that's how you say it. In his tales, you know, and that's just a compilation. It's like an anthology of stories. And he was directly influenced by Boccaccio's Decameron.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned that before, though. That was dedicated, or part of the title was towards Galahot or Galahot.
Yes.
Yeah. Which was Lancelot's best friend, Sir Galahot. So
But there's yeah, there's this
it's amazing
mirroring.
How this is all interconnected, all these effects.
Well, there's mirroring because Lancelot and the and Galahalt, you know, or I think he's called the Haut Prince.
Yeah, is that the same guy? I'm not sure. Well,
they start blurring a little bit, but I feel like Galahad is called the same. And Galahad and Galahot are very similar too. The P ones, so like Pelennor and Pelles, and there might even be one more P. So trying to keep
Pelium,
straight. Yeah. Which one is the maimed king? Which would be the Grail king?
Well, I was reading an article on the kind of inconsistencies within Malory, and this guy, the writer. Was making the point that with those names, Peleus and Pelium, even Malory screws it up, or his publisher does, or something. So it's like it's not consistent within Malory. Like there's a lot of inconsistencies, and then in time and in details, it's like Malory wasn't interested in that stuff in the same way that like modern readers are. So people were saying before, okay, maybe they're all separate books. Like he meant like to have eight separate romances, but then because there's inconsistencies between the books, but then these later scholars are saying, well, there's inconsistencies within the books also. Like he makes apparent mistakes in the timeline all the way through. So it's like he's focused on something else besides that kind of temporal coherence. But I was just going to say also on that point, it's like so you have all these earlier chronicles, like starting with Nennius way back, but then the most famous one is Geoffrey de Monmouth, right? History of the Kings of Britain. And that, in that story, Arthur's just a part of it. Like it's a big section in that, right? But Arthur's just a part of that. It starts all the way back with Troy, you know, and then the whole the Trojan War, and then the establishment of Britain by the descendants of the early Trojans. This guy Brute. And then the whole line, their whole line. So basically, Arthur is a descendant of Troy. But in that story, in that Arthur story, this is the big difference that comes out in Malory. And then I think it goes back to the French Vulgate, is that Arthur fights off the Saxons. And then he basically like takes over Ireland and Scotland and all the kind of northwest kingdoms, yeah. And then Monmouth says that it's basically they have 12 years of peace, yeah. And in the later chroniclers like Wace and Layamon, those guys, they're saying that is the time when he set up the Round Table, and so. Apparently, that's the time when all the quests went on, including the quest for the Holy Grail. But these guys don't mention it then. But then also, and so then after that period of peace, then they're like, "Hey, let's conquer France," and then that's when they get into trouble with the Romans, and then finally they have a huge battle with the Romans, and Arthur is. Victorious, he's about to march onto Rome and become the new emperor, basically. But then he hears that Modred, who he left in charge in Britain, has basically taken over and taken his wife and his kingdom. So he has to head back to Britain, and then the whole fight with Modred happens, and that's his final downfall, right? But and so that's the original timeline that you find in Geoffrey of Monmouth and Wace and Layamon and all the early chroniclers. But in the Vulgate in Malory, it's like That all happens at the beginning of Mallory. Like, you read the Mort d'Arthur, he's already fought the Romans. He already comes back. And then they have the quests, all the quests for the Holy Grail and stuff. And then there's the big break with Lancelot. And then it's Lancelot that he goes into France to fight Lancelot in his armies and leaves his kingdom in charge of Modred. And then he comes back, and then it's the same thing. He kills Modred, and Modred kind of slays him as well, although he leaves to Avalon, right? And so the timeline is way different. Like, he's already taken over Rome. Like I guess he's the Roman emperor or whatever in Mallory's take, or in the take of the Vulgate. Or I don't know how. How they reckon that with all the other, with the older chronicles. I don't know. It's interesting like that. I think the older way works better, and that might be part of the reason why the timeline in Mallory doesn't seem to work exactly.
So that was something I thought about. So, when we're reading Parsifal, you get the impression, you know, like that he was describing reality on some level, like the idea of the court and the knights.
Mm-hmm.
But with this one, I don't doubt that they're still fighting. And maybe I already mentioned that, but there's just something, it feels removed from, I don't have a sense of what life was really like. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. So what were you saying before? You made a list of books and when they're first published and stuff. So Mallory, what was it, 1478 or something, was when he first created it and published 1485.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Don Quixote was when?
Don Quixote is like same as Shakespeare, so like early 1600s, right? 1604 and 1610 or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like, I guess it's still about 200 years or less than that. Yeah, say about 150 years. But by the time of Don Quixote, that whole, like, he's kind of making fun of it at that time, right? Like the whole knights and romance and all of that. That's the whole point of the book, in a sense, is that that's kind of lost. It's, I don't know if he's making fun of it or just nostalgia for it or a bit of both, you know. So in the time of Mallory, you have the sense that it's already starting to pass out, you know, it's already starting to pass away, right?
But it has become so overblown, so ridiculous. So like the plate armor, you know, it just becomes ludicrous at some point.
Right.
Like, can they really move in there? You know, they're...
You mean actual knights at that time?
Right.
Yeah.
Because so in the 12th century, we've got like more of the chain,
mm-hmm.
They have some, like they have some kind of face things, they must, but yeah, it's just the evolution of fighting.
Yeah. And we've always got to keep in mind that they're always the... Whenever they are writing, like whether it's the 12th century or Mallory's time or whatever, it's like they're supposedly writing about like what the 500s or this early 600s. Yeah. So
it's a little, it's not, that is another place that kind of breaks down.
Yeah.
You know, because they're kind of writing about the current moment, but they're also saying that this is happening.
Yeah. They're projecting it back.
Yeah, I think what I may have bumped into is, you know, around this time, projectile weapons really became effective. And it's almost like the Jedi Knights, even though it seems so romantic, you know, with the blaster, you can wipe out a lot.
Yeah, they talk about the crossbow. I forget if that was in Mallory or the. I also read the alliterative Mordartar.
Yeah. How was that one?
Oh, it's good. It flew by, right? And that's following the old timeline again, where he fights against the Romans first, and then he has to come back to Britain because of Mordred. So it's a different timeline than Mallory. But I think in that one they're talking about crossbows, and Arthur's like, I'm not afraid of them, you know. So it might have been like a new sort of weapon, right? Like,
yeah. So with I think what's interesting is that poem is in a similar style as Sir Gawain. Yeah.
And the Green Knight.
Yeah. And those are both those are really fabulous literature.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the alliterative style is fun to read.
Yeah.
Which means, I don't know if everybody knows that or anyone who's listening, it just means using words of the same letter all the way through the line.
Yeah. But it's a much different style than what became popular, and so that's why there, I guess, are not that many examples of that survived.
Yeah. Actually, Tolkien wrote a lot of his lore in that style. Like some of his first stuff where he's writing just works of poetry before he started really getting into the prose, he would write in this alliterative style. I have kind of a modern translation of this, so you can't... So the alliteration is not present in every line. But I try to find something. And shortly, sharply search their surroundings, discovering the bowmen, and have a slight skirmish. Scare off their squires and also their scouts. Breach the barricades with their bright weapons. Beat down a battlement and gain the bridge. It's fun to read out loud this stuff.
Or if there's a really accomplished reader, it sounds pretty fabulous.
Yeah.
So what I'm experiencing is that with the Mallory, you end up with the whole universe, and then you don't know how to think about the pieces anymore. So what I realized was you can do a study of the individuals to trace their lineage and watch the stories move through different cultures. So something interesting is, you know, if Chrétien invented Lancelot or, you know, adapted an early Lancelot, before there was the Lancelot Grail, there's this missing link where you have to go and read about him in German, you know, so it goes from that to this German Lancelot, and then that's missing in the French, but then it picks up in the Lancelot Grail cycle. And then of course you're saying you have the post Bulgate cycle too. And so you could lose your mind with just one of them, you know, whether it's Tristan, Lancelot, or Arthur.
Yeah,
but after doing this, I feel like I've lost touch with the Grail. So let's talk about the actual Grail search and how it was different. My impression is in the stories that we read before, the Grail was in a specific location. And you had to either chance upon it or, you know, you spend your whole life looking for it. But it almost seemed like the Grail was everywhere, wherever they were.
Yeah.
You know, it's just they couldn't see it, but it was still taking care of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is it that Lancelot was healed by the Grail, and one of the other, Sir Hector as well, I think he was healed by the Grail.
Yeah.
It just sort of appeared. They're both about to die, and they it appeared out of nowhere and healed them. But it appears in a spectacular way on Pentecost, on the day of Pentecost, right? Where Arthur is giving court, and it just appears, and then Galahad shows up for the first time, and Galahad is able to sit in the at first there's another sword out of the stone moment.
Yeah.
And Galahad, it's only the pure knight who's able to do that. And then once he does that, he goes back to the round table and he's able to sit on the Siege Perilous. And everybody knows that he's the one who will attain the Grail. But by this time, the Grail is there. It's present. It's actually feeding people at that time, at that feast,
right,
in the Pentecost feast, right? It seems like the quest is not for the physical Grail itself, like the imagining that it's a cup that you attain or something, but it's to know the spiritual secrets of the Grail, which no knight is able to do. Like you have to be the best worldly knight, and then in addition to that, you have to be spiritually pure. Yeah, it reminds me of the story of the Buddha, like Siddhartha Buddha, right? Because he was a prince, and he was excellent at everything, like an excellent soldier, excellent whatever skills that were necessary in his court. Yeah, and then he became dissatisfied with it all, and had to make himself spiritually pure, and then he was able to attain enlightenment, right? So it's like that seems to be what the Grail has become. And just the fact that it appeared at the day of Pentecost, and it's like the day of Pentecost, traditionally, that's the appearance of the Holy Spirit, right? And so
the Holy Spirit isn't synonymous with this Grail, though, that we've been tracking. Like, there's always like the white dove and the one wafer.
Yeah, I was gonna say that. Like, even in Christian, like, there's the wafer. Like it's the Eucharist wafer that the hermit is able to live on, served by the Grail. So there's a connection. There's a Eucharistic connection all the way through, right? So I don't know. I just think that it's in the nature of the Holy Spirit, like what you're saying, like that it's supposed to be, it's everywhere in a sense, but only the very pure can actually see it or experience it.
There are a lot of dreams.
Yeah,
so there's
dreams and visions in that section. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of, you know, what do you call that type of, you know, it's a allegorical, but it's also, you know, like there were three birds and this bird betokened right. This item, and, you know, this is what the dream means.
A bunch of black bulls and three white bulls, and one of them had spots on it.
Right. Well, that bull was just not quite as pure, because
that bull was supposed to be Sir Bors. Yeah. He's the guy who lived to tell the tale, right? Like he was a necessary guy to come back to the Camelot and tell what happened.
Well, so right, and because the two were pure, Percival was not as pure as Sir Galahad, and so he didn't quote unquote achieve it, but they both died, right?
Yeah, in Saras, which is a bizarre place. I guess that also comes in with the prose Lancelot stuff. I mean, the Lancelot Grail stuff, the Vulgate stuff. But yeah, you wonder how all this stuff enters into the literature. Like, are these poets and writers just making up stuff, or they claim to have other texts that they're working on, right? So these other older texts are containing more information that was left out in the earlier romances, or they're just making it up. Like, but. That was 42 minutes, by the way.
Thanks for doing my job. I thought we had a few more. That was 42 minutes, by the way. Where's this? You've been listening to 42 Minutes, Seasonal Book Club, a production of Sick Book Radio and the sickbook.com. Did you notice the last time when we put the always record up, it just totally crashed the website. It was so malware infected, it just completely crashed and had to get completely rebuilt. But it's back, baby, better than ever. For more information about the Sync Book, our guest, check out past shows, or subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Please be sure and visit our website, thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, check out others, as currently all the Sync Book radio archives are free. All this and more can be found at syncbook.com. Thank you so much, and oh, blessed Jesu, help him throw his might. Amen. Great.
With thee will.
Would you have me dancing out of my